Welcome back to another episode of Firewall. As usual, I'm your host, Bradley Tusk. With me today is a guest that I've only met in the last 11 minutes or 7 minutes, and I think our team only maybe for the last week or so, but we met her and said we got to have her on the podcast. Katie Stewart. Katie, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I'll give your bio because I suspect that you would be modest and leave half of it out if I asked you to do it. And your work is sort of different than probably a lot of the guests that come on this podcast in that it's really focused kind of on branding and design and kind of how things look and feel. As opposed to sort of underlying technology or political strategy or things like that. So you founded Cheyenne Studios in 2017. You'd been in different ad agencies for a decade before that. You know, you work on really big brands like Google and Apple and Under Armour. You host a podcast called In the Making about how to build brands, companies, and campaigns. So that's a pretty cool, it's like the kind of thing that like, you would imagine a character on a TV show about someone who comes to New York gets to do, you know, how they like all live in these amazing apartments and yet they have jobs that don't pay that, you know, it's like, that's the kind of like how your career is like the career version of that.
Totally. It's what they sell you on in art school. And then you come to find out it doesn't go that way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So why'd you start your company? Why not just keep working at big ad agencies and making a lot of money?
Yeah, well, the agency lifestyle and demeanor, if you will, just wasn't for me. I think agencies were really cool. I met so many talented, amazing, really smart people. And we got to work with all sorts of different brands, like you said, from like Google to Apple to Verizon and ASICS. But the culture around agency life is probably very similar to the culture around a tech startup or a political campaign in that it's very go, 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 work 24/7. And if your work is not your life, you're doing something wrong. So that culture of just doing nothing but advertising all day, every day, and then also working for brands that you might not always agree with or want to promote because you're at a large agency, they bring the clients in and you just get put on that project. And you might find yourself working on a brand that you don't agree with their values or what they're doing. And you look at it and you're like, why am I up at 4 a.m. writing a script and art directing a commercial for this company whose values I don't really respect? And I think the combination of those things drove me to want to work for myself. And in 2017, I just had the opportunity where, you know, I had some clients come to me directly, and that gave me the opportunity to start building that business and building a business in a way where we work really transparently with the clients so that they know what we're doing, we know what they're doing, expectations are set, and we're not making ourselves crazy staying up all night, like doing design work at the last minute. That's probably not going to come out very well because we did it at 2 a.m. So we don't do that. And we set expectations, we're organized, and then we also get to choose our clients. So we've been really fortunate to get to work with some really amazing organizations. We're not necessarily just working with mission-based companies, but we have been fortunate to work with companies like Habit Advisors, who do harassment and inclusion and bias training in the workplace, and Myriad Women's Health, who is an organization trying to transform and empower women to understand their health. And things like this are really inspiring to me and my team because we care about the mission of those companies as well, and therefore the work is better. So I think ultimately that's what has driven the development of Cheyenne Studio, and that's kind of what drives us to kind of keep doing the work every day.
What kind of stuff do you typically say no to that you just don't want to work on?
Honestly, I haven't had a ton of projects come in where we've had to say no, because luckily most people that approach us have been very like-minded. And I think that is because we do an intro call. I meet with the founders or the team in charge and we get to know each other. So generally, if they move forward and we put a proposal together for them, we know it could be a good fit. The only project that I can recall recently that was a hard no was just for It's kind of ironic because I actually supported their cause, but I thought it could cause legal problems for us. They were trying to do a, you know, anti-Trump product, which was actually a really fun idea, and I supported their idea, but they were using some verbiage that the Trump campaign uses, and they wouldn't get away from that, and we felt like it could be a lawsuit if we helped them out. So we stayed away from that. But in terms of like big evil corporations, if you will, we haven't been approached by many.
Right. So they're not calling you in the first place.
They're not calling. I think we, you know, if you look at the work on our website, it aligns with certain viewpoints. And I think people that are inspired by that are who reach out to us and come to us.
And so I know you work with both kind of big companies and also, you know, smaller tech startups. So if you're the founder of a tech startup and you're at, I don't know, Series A or Series B, how should you be thinking about your brand?
In my view, your branding should always be top of mind, whether you're just at the initial beginning where you're putting together your investor deck and trying to get people interested in investing in your company, or if you have those investors and you're ready to launch to consumers. Brand is something that builds not only trust and makes you look experienced and professional, but it's also something that helps people want to engage with your product. And I think sometimes branding in tech companies specifically takes the backseat a little bit, because tech companies are really about the technology and how it works and exactly what it's doing. And a lot of times their clients are about that as well. But if you look at the companies that have succeeded, they've incorporated design into every element of their brand, whether it's Apple, who I think has really led user experience design in the last couple of decades in our country, or, you know, Google is the same thing. So if you look at big tech companies, they're thinking about branding not only in the logo and the look and feel, but in the interactions that users experience throughout their website and throughout their product as well. So I think it's really something that needs to be top of mind from the start and then continue to evolve with the brand as it develops.
And so how often do you feel like founders kind of understand that and are willing to invest their resources in it? And how often are they just focused on kind of the underlying tech and it's really kind of an uphill battle to convince them of that?
It depends. I think there are plenty of founders that know it's important. What I think they often miss is the value, the monetary value of it. You know, I think a lot of tech founders might be like, we know we need a cool logo and website, but we think it should cost $500, you know, and yeah. That's like legit something that we get sometimes. And companies that I know have had millions of dollars in funding will sometimes have these tiny, tiny budgets for their brand and their design. And, you know, for them, I think it's just understanding that actually considering design and thinking about the brand on a conceptual level is more than just making something pretty and throwing it up on the internet. And that actually takes a lot of skill and strategy and thinking, and it's a lot more involved than a junior designer just churning out a logo in a couple of hours. So I think most people know they need to do it. It's just understanding that it is an investment in the business that is worthwhile, that I think sometimes needs to come through a little bit more.
And, you know, do you think there's a distinction kind of in how much of a kind of priority it should be budget-wise for a consumer products startup compared to someone who's just like an enterprise completely? Or do you think it really applies across the board?
I would say it applies across the board, but in different ways. Obviously, if it's a consumer product, you're going to want to do a lot more paid media and have your brand out there in ads and be seen by the public in a really friendly and welcoming consumer-facing way. Something that's more of a B2B product, where you're really talking to people within your industry, you can get a little bit more in depth in your messaging with details and technical points. But I would still say, even people within your industry, no matter how niche your industry may be, appreciate a clean design, appreciate being able to get to the points they're looking for and fully understand what your product does and feels more comfortable seeing that you have a well-considered, thought-through brand. And I think at this point, you know, it's 2020. We do everything online at this point. And people are used to going to well-designed, thoughtful, and considered websites and interacting with brands that are the same way. So I think at this point, if you're not focusing your brand in that, with that philosophy in mind, no matter who your audience is, they expect it.
Right. So consumers are so sophisticated at this point that even if they don't know what goes into making the sausage, if the product ultimately isn't there, they'll sense it on some level.
Yeah. Yeah. I think at this point, the expected level of basic design knowledge and basic design aesthetic that any brand needs to have is much higher than it used to be, because we interact with all these great brands every day. That if you go from, I don't know, Nike's website to some tech brand's website you never heard of, you're going to see a bit of a difference. But if the tech brand site looks like the designers are from 1999 and haven't updated it, you might not trust that they know what they're doing with their technology, even if they're saying all the right things.
Right. So I know you and Sheila, when she was on your podcast, I guess she was on as a Biden surrogate, right? But when she came, or Harris surrogate, something like that, but she... You guys ended up talking about mobile voting because she was excited about that, and we talked about it afterwards. If the goal, which it should be, but often is not, was to get as many people to vote as possible, how would ballots be designed? If they made you king of elections, what would you do?
I would love to be king of elections, just because that's a really cool title. But I think it is expected these days that almost anything you do, you can do online. And generationally, anyone who's coming after my generation, Gen Z and the next generation, are even going to feel this way even more. We need to go meet people where they are. So mobile voting, voting digitally in some capacity, is something that needs to happen. And if I were king of elections, you know, I can't solve all the issues with it. I'm not going to try to claim to be some kind of technology expert, but designing something from a visual standpoint that you just open up, it's a really simple form field, you choose who you're voting for, you press on your call to action, and it gets sent in. That is the ideal. Just a very simple multiple choice form field. We see it in a lot of other, you know, websites and apps that we interact with all the time. So from a visual design perspective, just something very simple and familiar everybody could use. It's a couple clicks to check off who you want to vote for, and you press send and you are done, would be the ideal situation.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I wonder if there's almost a parallel in the same way that consumers have gotten so sophisticated that if your design is not acceptable, they're going to notice, even if it's just subconsciously. Do you feel like, especially the consumers that your clients are typically interested in, that because the process of voting and kind of the design of the whole system is so inelegant and inefficient, it just inherently turns them away and means that they just don't vote most of the time?
Oh, completely. I mean, my friends and I'm a millennial, so my generation, I think this year we're all voting. We can't not. But I even have fears about casting my mail-in ballot because I know there are ways I might mess it up that I didn't even realize. I have to make sure I'm using a certain color ink. I need to make sure my signature matches. I have no idea what my signature registered with the government even looks like, because when's the last time I signed a document that like mattered in that way? Like, I don't even think my credit card has a signature. So there are so many ways that it could go wrong that I am more intimidated by a mail-in ballot than I would be by a form field. And I think Gen Z, who's the new millennial, if you will, all our clients now, we're older and not the cool ones to target to anymore. Gen Z is now who we need to be advertising for and talking to. And they're also the newest group of voters. And they've grown up with this to the point where I think going somewhere physically in person or casting a mail-in ballot is so foreign to them that that experience is almost more difficult. Not almost, it is more difficult.
Yeah. I mean, they don't do it, right? I mean, and listeners of this podcast are probably sick of me you giving out these stats, but, you know, typical turnout in primaries is around 12 to 15%. And because of gerrymandering, the primary really is the only election that matters 98, 99% of the time, which means, you know, 12 to 15% of each party are picking our elected officials. And then we wonder why we have these elected officials that only want to fight, don't want to get anything done. That's what they were elected to do, you know? So it's not shocking at all. But it's funny, even as the person who's trying to kind of get mobile voting adopted in the U.S., I'm going to vote in person this year, and I know it'll probably suck 2 hours out of my day, but I really, really, really want to cast a vote against Trump and know that it's counted. And if I have to wait for a long time, I feel like this year I'm willing to do that. But, you know, for your average city council primary, am I willing to do that? No, of course not, right? And I'm, you know, I really care about this stuff. So how do you think about your own podcast? I think about this question a lot in the context of Cheyenne's brand and your brand. Why did you create your podcast, and how do you use it to kind of build the business?
Yeah. So to be fully transparent, I really just created the podcast initially. It was not some intelligent business venture. It was really just that I was interested in how people were building things. I think I was about a year and a half into my company, and, you know, as a new entrepreneur, figuring out, okay, so I started this business, now how do I shift it to really scale it and make it a real business and continue to grow it and be profitable, etc. And I started having these conversations with friends, and I happen to have a lot of other friends who are also entrepreneurs and doing their own thing in different industries. And just starting to have these conversations, I found what they were talking about to be just really fascinating, especially mm-hmm. things like the manufacturing process, like how you physically make a thing and get it to the United States and then get it in someone's hand, kind of blew my mind. So it kind of just grew out of me being fascinated in how other people were building their businesses and what went on behind the scenes. And then the mentality that they were taking to approach their business that might be a different business model than my own, but might actually apply to what I was doing. So that's where it started. And in the making, our podcast was left intentionally vague, might be the word, or broad in terms of subject matter, so that we could talk to people who are in the making of all sorts of things, whether it is a business, or maybe it's an art gallery, maybe it's a musician, maybe it's a campaign, which is where we talked to Sheila about mobile voting. Yeah. And yeah. It's just opened up this great discussion and community around how to build something. And by doing it, I've kind of found that there's actually a lot of crossover, whether you're making a business to sell a physical product, whether you're making a business like mine, where it's a service-based business, whether you're creating an art gallery, or you're working on a campaign, there's a lot of the same elements can be applied to all of these things. So it's just really interesting to hear. And I think the audience is probably mainly other people that have the same curiosities and are also trying to build their own thing, whatever that thing may be, and just want to hear how other people are going about it.
So do you feel like having the podcast kind of helps you build Cheyenne's brand overall, or is it just something that, hey, I enjoy doing this, I get to talk to interesting people? Because yeah, I mean, one thing that I've learned too is people love being guests on podcasts, right?
Oh, so
it's amazing how you can get these really smart people just because they enjoy it, at least if you're nice to them, I guess. But so is it more like, hey, because people love podcasts, I can get access to these people and just pick their brain? Or do you use it deliberately also to try to drive awareness of the company itself?
Yeah, I definitely use it for awareness as well. And I think beyond intentional awareness, it's been a great way to just build up a network, especially in 2020 when we're all kind of stuck at home and we can't go to events and meet new people. It's been a great way to just venture out and meet these new people I would never have any contact with and get to talk to them like we're doing right now online. And just expand that network, and then they know other people and they know other people. So that's how referrals really get generated. And my business is really a referral-based industry. And then beyond that, for our season two, we focused specifically on female entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. which, again, just based on a lot of the work we do, that tends to be the client base we have often. We have a lot of female founders who like to work with us. So it was a great foot in the door, I would say, for us to meet these entrepreneurs, talk to them. And I would actually say the podcast listeners are not so much the people who will probably become clients in the future. It's the guests who I built this greater connection with and really got to know through the process who,
yeah,
when their business grows, may come to us, or they might refer a friend to us, or maybe we'll partner on something down the road. Maybe we'll have a great idea and do some work together. And that's the benefit. Have you found?
Right. That's interesting. You know, well, it's, yeah, same thing. I mean, I don't know that if our listeners are generating deal flow for our venture fund or anything like that, but clearly, if you want to get to know someone, having them on the podcast makes sense. In a way, somehow the act of a podcast is just more intimate than like even if you just were doing some sort of traditional interview with somebody. There's something about the format that just people kind of relax and are willing to be pretty candid in my experience. And the ones who aren't are usually bad guests. And as a result, it does create more of a bond. In fact, a piece of advice that I tend to give politicians all the time is go on as many podcasts as you can, because if someone spends half an hour listening to you on a podcast, they're going to feel like if you do a good job, they're going to feel like they know you. And it's going to form a deeper connection with a potential voter or a voter than kind of, you know, 8 different TV hits that they see you on for a soundbite for 7 seconds each, right? They don't all take that advice, but I think that they should. And one person I know that did that really successfully was AOC, you know, when she was running for office at first and had no chance at all, right? She went on every podcast that would have her. And I think she was able to connect with kind of the core voters that she needed. And that was at least a part of how she won. So yeah, it does feel like it's a way to connect. You connect with listeners in a way that's just different than any other format. And so how do you decide now how to spend kind of time on the podcast compared to the rest of your business? Do you ultimately see the podcast as something that becomes a significant revenue generator in and of itself, or what's your plan for it?
Yeah, I see it as a long-term revenue generator. I don't think any of my contacts from the podcast are necessarily going to turn around the day after I talk to them and say, I have a project for you. Let's get involved now. But I think it is just, it's a network builder and it's a long-term goal, if you will. It's just, I think why it works is because there is something more genuine about it. It's not just putting an ad out in the world. It's actually meeting people and having real conversations with them. And after you spent 30 minutes talking to somebody, no matter what you're talking about, you feel like, wow, we just had a real genuine conversation, and you get to know their personality. You get to understand how they think a little bit. And it's a real connection, more so than you would even make if you go to some kind of networking event and you just say, hi, I'm Katie. Great to meet you. Here's my business card. Like, that's not a real connection. But I think podcasts are really helpful in forming more genuine relationships that in the long run, you have to be patient, I think, but in the long run will lead to more referrals and will drive more interactions that will be helpful for, I think, both parties.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so I see it as helping in that way. And then I think, you know, the other thing is just how unexpected it could be. Like, I never thought I would have representatives from a political campaign on my podcast. It wasn't something I thought of a year ago, but it just seemed like a great fit. And the time came up, and all of a sudden, by having, you know, 5 women who are on the Biden-Harris campaign talk to me a few weeks ago, it opened my mind up to everything that goes on in the campaign and saw a new side of it, where you don't just see like the campaign candidates who are up on TV all the time, but you actually get to understand the people working on it. So it just, I don't know. I think there's so many opportunities to learn and to grow through it as well.
So you mentioned that season 2 is really focused on female entrepreneurs. Who are some of your favorites?
Oh, there's a ton of them. So one I would say is a woman named Lisa Anderson Schaefer. She's a founder of a company named Zelma Rose, and it's a sustainable jewelry company in Sausalito. And she makes these really beautiful hand-woven, chunky necklaces and other jewelry. And she just, she also does philosophy. So she's just a woman that has all of these wonderful thoughts, and she was great to talk to. Who else did I talk to? Oh, I would say 50s Gifts was really cool. The founder is Constance Patton. And 50s, this was, I would say, early March I spoke to her. And this was before everything happened with George Floyd and the racial injustice going on in our country. And she was already working on this company where she curates products created by Black founders. And then she sells them as these gift boxes you could buy directly from her website. So she's helping Black makers get their products out into the world by curating them into these larger packages. So it's not just a small vendor selling to people directly, but there's this bigger product you can buy. And you can go to her site, and she has all these curated Black makers that she sells from. And I thought it was really amazing how she was focusing on lifting up the Black Americans in the economy through her company. And it was kind of genius. And I think after this summer and this year, there's a lot more conversation around that. But she was just kind of ahead of all that and just doing this great thing already. So she was really cool as well.
Very cool. All right. So to wrap it up, how do people find you, whether it's to listen to the podcast or learn more about you or work with Shiana or anything else?
Yeah. So the podcast is on Apple, Spotify, pretty much all the podcast sites. It's called In the Making by Shion Studio. I recommend putting by Shion Studio with it because it comes up quicker. And then our website is Shion, Shion studio.com. And you can check it out and see some of our work and get to know more about what we do.
Cool. Katie Stewart, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Bradley.